Welcome to the NFID podcast, Infectious Ideas. This is Marla Dalton, NFID Executive Director and CEO. And with me is my co-host, Dr. Bill Schaffner. Bill, it's always great to have you.
Hi, Marla. Good to be with you.
Our guest today is Dr. Lena Wen, an emergency physician and non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She is also a columnist for the Washington Post, where she writes a twice-weekly column on public health and health policy. She previously served as Baltimore's health commissioner, where she led the nation's oldest continuously operating public health department. She received her medical degree from Washington University School of Medicine and studied health policy at the University of Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. She has been named as one of modern healthcare's top 50 physician executives and Time's 100 most influential people. Lena, thank you so much for joining us. In your most recent book, Lifelines, you wrote about your childhood and your family's incredible story, beginning with your immigration to the U.S. from China. It's really such an amazing and inspiring story. And for those who have not yet read the book, I highly recommend it. So how did that experience affect your remarkable path, graduating from college at such an early age and ultimately pursuing a career in medicine?
First of all, thank you so much for having me on your show, Marla, and it's great to join you and Bill. Bill and I have worked together virtually over the course of the pandemic, and I truly admire the work that you all do, so thank you. You mentioned about my childhood. So I was born in China. My parents and I came to the U.S. just before I turned 8, and we lived in some areas in Los Angeles after we moved here that were challenging, where I saw many people, including my neighbors, my parents' friends, who often went without access to healthcare. And I saw through these experiences just how much we do not in this country see healthcare as a right, and that the access that people have very much depends on how much income they make, where they live, and at times their immigration status. All of them very much influenced my desire to pursue a career in medicine. And then something else happened when I started medical school, which was that my mother ended up being misdiagnosed for about a year before she was finally diagnosed with what turned out to be metastatic breast cancer. Her illness and her subsequent cancer treatments entirely coincided with my own medical training, with medical school residency. So being a patient advocate, as well as being someone deeply rooted in the community and addressing the needs of the patients that I see, understanding the context of who they are and where they are in their lives, I think all of those are due to my personal experiences.
Fascinating.
Lena, it's so good to be with you again. I observed that you chose as a specialty emergency medicine, taking care of very acutely ill patients. How is it that you became interested in public health, which of course led you to serve as health commissioner in Baltimore?
In medical training, I don't think I was aware of the concept of public health. Of course, I understood that there was a field called public health, but I don't think I quite understood how much of what we did in the emergency department every day intersected with public health. But in a sense, working in the emergency department, you see all the aspects of public health and healthcare. You see the failures of our healthcare system with boarding in the emergency department and patients not being able to get beds. You see the issues with struggling to get, for example, access to mental health care and the lack of acute care and community care for mental health. And then you also see the failures of our public health system or our public health infrastructure that led patients to seek emergency care. I remember seeing patients who would come to our ED all the time for addiction, for issues related to homelessness, for problems with not being able to get their chronic health care needs attended to, for failure of preventive care or lack of preventive care, for inability to afford medications for epilepsy, and that's why they're here for a seizure, or inability to care for their chronic illnesses like diabetes and congestive heart failure. By experience in the emergency department influenced my understanding of public health, and in a sense was my introduction to the importance of public health as well as the needs in public health too.
That's certainly very vivid. Now, Once you found yourself as the commissioner, what were your greatest challenges and successes in that role?
The challenges in Baltimore, I think, are similar to what we see in many other parts of the country. A child born today in the city, depending on the part of town that they're born in, could expect to live 20 years less or more, depending on simply the zip code. That is mirrored in St. Louis, where I went to medical school. That's mirrored in LA, where I grew up. That's mirrored really all throughout the country. And so this idea of poverty and the social determinants of health being so closely linked to health outcomes, that's something that is a great challenge in public health. But I would say that there are ways to start addressing these challenges too. And one of the things I very much believe in is that there are things that you can do. There are practical steps that one can take that are short-term, that can make a difference short-term to the individuals that you serve, that can also contribute long-term as well as to the population. So I'll give you a couple of examples of this. We have a program at Baltimore that's still going on strong now called Be More for Healthy Babies. This is a public-private collaboration that involves over 150 partners, including hospitals, insurers, church groups, nonprofit groups, and so forth, that focuses on one goal, which is to reduce infant mortality. And we do this by providing home visits for pregnant women and postpartum families, by assisting with housing, by assisting with mental health needs, physical health, et cetera, providing free cribs. And in 7 years, we were able to reduce infant mortality in our city by 38%.
Wow.
By the way, while we did that, we also reduced the disparity between Black and white infant mortality by over 50%. And I give these numbers because I think sometimes there is this understanding that addressing disparities is a zero-sum game. That in order to narrow this gap in life expectancy, that you have to take years of life from one group and add it to another. That's not the case. I want to make the case, and I think we in public health need to make the case clearer, that addressing disparities and focusing on the most vulnerable is crucial because all boats rise. Because if you are addressing the infrastructure, you're improving health for everyone. But that you cannot just say, let's improve health outcomes without also addressing disparities. And that there is a way to do both, that you can be intentional about doing both. So I think that Be More for Healthy Babies example is one. And I'll give you maybe two more in this vein. Along with the emphasis on healthy babies, we also wanted to address school health. And we have school health suites in every one of our schools in Baltimore and expanded mental health services at that time to more than half of our schools. We also started a program to get glasses to every child who needs them in Baltimore. Again, this is not the solution to education problems or to child health and wellness. But if kids can't see, they can't read. I don't need another study to tell me that. And so being able to do something as basic as providing glasses is crucial for showing people that we are doing something tangible that's short term that could lead to long term improvements as well. And then the last example I'll give you is around addiction services. I issued a standing order in our city for every resident to get naloxone, the opioid antidote, which is routine across the country now, but at that time, 9 years ago, it was relatively new. That resulted in 3 years in over 3,000 lives being saved in our city. And at the same time, we increased treatment services as well. I wanted to give that example too, because so often you see a problem that's really big, like addiction, and you say, where do I start? I think in public health, there's often this tendency to look at the problems and say, this is so complicated. Everything is related to each other. So where do I even begin? But there are things that we can do right now, things that are tangible. And even if they don't solve everything, you got to start somewhere.
I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but this reminds me of what I have been told is a Chinese proverb. Long journeys begin with first steps. And you certainly have exemplified that.
That's a great quote. So thank you for raising it.
NFID did provide a number of materials for the Be More for Babies, particularly around maternal vaccination. So we'll take a tiny little piece of the credit there as well. But it is a pretty remarkable success story, I think. And if we can scale and replicate that across the country, I think we'd all be better off. I'm going to take a quick quote from your book that talks about it wasn't just healthcare that your patients needed, it was public health. And public health is housing, food, clean air, and education. That ability to level the unequal playing field and the social supports that give everyone the best chance to survive. You've obviously highlighted that very well from your examples. If you could change just one thing about the field of public health, what would that be?
Yeah, that's a great question. And sometimes in public health, sometimes we look at a problem that big that involves all these different aspects and we throw up our hands and say the problem is just too big. And what I want to, in writing this book, to challenge people to think, yes, the problem is so big, but what is the piece of the problem that I can tackle? From my vantage point, no matter where I am, whether it's in academia, as a practicing clinician, working in a community health center, working as a volunteer, as a college student, wherever I am in this process, what can I do right now? And how can what I do right now contribute in this larger way? And maybe right now it is providing healthcare. It's okay. It doesn't mean that just because you have to address these other elements, also that what you're doing in providing healthcare is sufficient or is bad. You are doing everything that you can. And so I think while we understand and address these bigger issues, let's not also forget the role that these individual decisions and individual actions can have and the crucial role that they must have in improving people's lives too. The biggest takeaway that I hope that people will learn, I would say that in public health, we sometimes assume that everyone feels the way that we do, and they don't. And it's for a variety of reasons. So often we talk about misinformation or disinformation. That is true. But I think a lot of times we need to start from the assumption that people just don't know what we know. They haven't gone through all this training. They haven't had these same life experiences, but they've had other life experiences. They have other ways of thinking that are also important and that are important for us to understand. And so my biggest takeaway is we got to go back to a core principle of public health, which is to meet people where they are. And we need to listen. We need to understand where people are coming from. And then we need to meet them with what we know is the case in public health. But let's help them to get to where we are instead of pointing to someone and saying, you must be a bad person because you don't share all my views on this topic. And so I'm writing you off. We just can't afford to do that. First of all, these are people that we serve, so we can't write anyone off. But also, many of these people can actually be moved once we understand what their concerns are and what issues matter to them. I think a lot about this come election time, and I'm not trying to make any partisan comment here at all, but rather just saying that a lot of times people will campaign on topics that are not related to public health at all, right? It's very rare for someone to say, I'm running for mayor on a public health platform. More often than not, they're going to say, I care about education, I care about jobs, I care about public safety. We know that there is a direct line from all of these issues to public health. And it's our job as public health practitioners to get them to see that. We need them to see how if we don't address issues related to mental health and addiction, then we're not really addressing public safety. Or if you care about education, you should also care about children's well-being. Or if you care about jobs, you should care about workers being healthy, et cetera. So we need to be making that case instead of sometimes there is this righteousness in public health and we say we are right and they are wrong. And if they don't care, there's something wrong with them. Maybe let's give them the benefit of a doubt and put the onus on us to get them to care.
Sounds like maybe you should think about running for something, Lena.
No, that is not in my future at all. I have great respect for people who do, but this is not in my future.
Although you would have two votes, so.
Exactly. I had a similar thought, but I think we'll put that aside. Implicit in what you have been saying is that we have a deficit in trust at the moment in our population, trust in public health and medical science. You've observed that public health officials made some unforced errors during the COVID-19 pandemic. What are the lessons there? Can you elaborate on that?
I've been thinking about this from a very specific standpoint, which is what is the difference in how we as clinicians speak to our patients versus how do public health officials speak to the public? So let me explain. When we as clinicians speak to our patients, I would say the vast majority, if somebody says, I don't believe in vaccines, or I don't want to get vaccinated, our first reaction, I would say really almost never, if ever, is to say, oh, there must be something wrong with you. Why do you believe in misinformation? Oh, you must have listened to things that are not true and you're a bad person, right? We would never say that. Our reaction is going to be, tell me more. Why do you not want to get vaccinated? And then if they express a particular concern, for example, they read somewhere that vaccines are related to getting magnetized, or they say, I don't need to get vaccinated because I just had COVID. Whatever the issue is, we listen to them. We help them to understand, is that something that's true? Is that something that's maybe true, but we don't know? Is that something that's false? And here's the reason why. We address their concerns and we help them to come to the solution that's best for them in their lives. That is what we do for every issue. That is what we do around COVID. And that's what we do on an interpersonal level. Somehow, though, the same clinicians or the same individuals, when asked to give public health advice, end up saying things that come across as scolding or berating or belittling when they speak from a public health lens. And it sounds like, well, the people who don't think exactly as we do, there must be something wrong with them. And of course, that kind of message becomes very alienating. Now, those same individuals would never do this on a one-on-one medical context, but somehow that is how it sounds when given on a population level. That is, to me, the crux of the unforced error, if you will, to your question, Bill, which is that we're not speaking to people with empathy and understanding and compassion. Instead, we are making assumptions about who they are and actually dismissing some of the very legitimate, in some cases, concerns that they have or questions that they have. The fact that, for example, we in the public health community dismissed the idea of natural immunity following recovery from COVID, I think a lot of people have not forgiven us for that. They have not forgotten. And there is almost this kind of public health orthodoxy that developed during COVID that unless you believe all of this, that you must be a bad person who is anti-science and we're writing you off. Well, I think as a result of that approach, we've alienated a substantial portion of the American public who now do not trust public health, not just on COVID, but on other topics as well. And that really worries me.
We would like to take a quick break from infectious ideas to share some information about the annual Conference on Vaccinology Research on May 8 to 10, 2024. Ready to dive into the latest breakthroughs in vaccinology research? Join NFID online for the annual Conference on Vaccinology Research on May 8 to 10, 2024. Don't miss this opportunity to connect with experts and help shape the future of vaccine development. Register at nfid.org/ACVR to secure your spot. I'll just shift gears for a moment now. And it's been very difficult for so many to find a healthy balance between home and work lives. So as a mom with two young children, I'd love to know how you find an appropriate balance and what you like to do for fun and to relax.
Before I had children, I went to a number of talks on work-life balance. And I actually realized after I had children that my conception of work-life balance pre-having kids is not what it is now. I had envisioned work-life balance as this one-time choice, as in you decide when you get a job what your work-life balance is going to be in your life. And I didn't quite appreciate how it's a decision that you have to make every day. Every day, there's a decision about, do I pick up the kids early and we do something fun? Or do I finish this report? Or do I stay up late and work on this, but with the understanding that I could have dinner with my kids? There are many choices about this balance every day. I have a three-year-old and a six-year-old, and part of my balance is being friends with other parents with similar age kids. Our kids can play together, and also we can share advice and support with one another. But I am also a triathlete, so I love endurance sports. I love trail running and open water swimming, and that's a big part of my fun. To me, it's fun and relaxing. I know it may not be for everyone, but that's a big part of the community that I love and am grateful to have fostered here in Baltimore.
That sounds great. And it certainly sounds as though you take the long view, if I can say that. But Lena, each year for the Washington Post, you get out your crystal ball and you put together a list of top 10 medical and public health issues that you anticipate will dominate the headlines. So this is a bit of a twist, but what are the top health stories that are not being covered, but really should be?
That's a great question. There are some issues that are being covered that I think should be covered more. And then I think there's one that is not being covered. So I'll explain both categories. The things that I think should be covered more include climate change and health, and specifically what the healthcare sector needs to do and is already doing to address the issue of climate change. A lot is being written on AI in healthcare. I think a lot more needs to be written on here because this is such a quickly developing field. And then I would say, too, GLP-1s. That revolution is here as well. And the cost trade-offs and how we're going to pay for GLP-1s is something that we need to speak a lot more of. And here I'm referring to medications like semaglutide and tirzepatide, known as Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, and Zepbound, these medications that were initially developed to treat diabetes that are also showing great efficacy for weight loss as well. So those are things that are already being covered, but I think need more coverage. The one issue that I think is not being covered is going to sound a little bit vague, but let me explain. In the media, but also in our public discourse in general, whether it's medicine or public health, sometimes there is this lack of willingness to explain that two things could be true at the same time. So you could have something, as I wrote about last year in a series, like psychedelic drugs that show great potential for treating severe depression and PTSD, but that if just given without instruction may cause a lot of harm. Or we could talk about how we need to do a lot more research into marijuana and decriminalizing. It may be time to do that. However, unrestrained recreational use, especially among youth and young people, is really not a good thing either. And so I think that kind of discussion of trade-offs, the idea that two things can be true, let's discuss both of it without necessarily saying psychedelics are good or psychedelics are bad or marijuana is good or marijuana is bad. I think delving into those nuances is what I would like to see a lot more of.
So from among your list, what most keeps you awake at night these days?
In Lifelines, in my book, I wrote about how public health saved your life today. You just don't know it. I think now people know about public health, but they know the wrong thing about it. And that's what I am really worried about. My problem prior to COVID was that people just didn't think about public health. My concern now is that they think about it, but they think that it's some kind of top-down government infringing on your rights. We see this with state legislatures that are very quickly trying to restrain the rights or the ability of public health officials to enact emergency powers in the future. If there are problems, we see this with declining childhood immunization rates, as I know you are extremely concerned about. And so what keeps me awake is how do we turn around this narrative that public health is something to be demonized?
We've been asking guests to comment on the most notable changes related to infectious diseases that they've seen throughout their careers. So we'd love to hear your thoughts as well as any predictions you may have for the future. And by the way, what's the title of your next book?
I don't have a next book in mind yet. So far, I'm on a every 10-year strategy. So I've got 7 more years before I have to think about this. My prediction for the future is that what we do not know and what we are not predicting is going to be the biggest problem. There are things that, of course, we're all worried about and that I think are more likely than not going to happen. It's so tragic that we're seeing the return of vaccine-preventable diseases that are surging. And I think that's horrible. And I think we will unfortunately see more of that. But I'm even more concerned, I think, about the things that we don't know are going to be the problems coming up, the diseases emerging in the future. And our ability to deal with that may be constrained because of what happened during COVID.
Before we sign off, first of all, I'd love to thank you again for being with us. It was such an enjoyable discussion. And we hate for it to end, but I would like to give you the same opportunity that we give to all of our guests. And that is, what is the myth that you would most like to bust?
The myth that I would like to most bust is the idea that following the science alone is enough. Of course, I believe in follow the science. Of course, I believe that everything we do needs to be evidence-based, needs to be science-based. But I think that somehow during COVID, there has been this understanding that there is one right answer. And that is just not the case. Science may have a very specific and direct answer. But public health policy, there's no direct line from that science to policy. By definition, public health is about balancing priorities. It's about weighing two very complicated issues that are often at odds with one another, which is what is best for the individual versus what is best for society. And public health policy often has to walk that very careful line between infringing on individual rights, but for the best of society. Now, those types of trade-offs are complicated. They are nuanced. Policymakers sit in rooms for hours, days, coming up with pro and con lists, and their decisions must be based on science. But it's not clear what those trade-offs are. And I think people who have tried to say, my answer is right because I'm following the science, that is just not accurate. And I would love for public health experts, officials, et cetera, to be a lot more humble and a lot more nuanced in the way that they communicate going forward.
Lena, I think what you've said is just profound, and I hope our colleagues in public health were listening. I couldn't agree more. Science is the foundation for what we do, but then when you translate the science into public policy, as you say, there are options.
I totally agree with you there. I think it's important for policymakers to explain the basis behind their decisions. And we in public health need to help them with that by saying, I'm following the science, therefore I'm doing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And instead, we could say exactly as you were saying, that science is the foundation for what we do. But policymaking is a lot more complicated than that.
Exactly. We've been talking today with Dr. Lena Wen, emergency medicine doctor, public health doctor, parent, and journalist. Thanks again for joining us, Lena. And thanks to everyone for listening to this episode of Infectious Ideas, a podcast series presented by the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases, where leading experts join us for thought-provoking conversations that lead to infectious ideas. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And if you'd like more information about NFID, be sure to visit us online at nfid.org. Until next time.